not a message about how to take an offering in church. If it was that was the point of the message, it'd be entitled Passing the Plate. Okay. All right. Well, you've all heard the expression pass the buck. That phrase means to shift blame or to shift responsibility. Apparently, the saying originated in the mid-19th century from the card game poker. The buck was a small object, usually a knife, used as a marker to indicate the next dealer. And it's thought that the name came from the knife handles, which were commonly made from buckhorn. Now, the most famous use of the expression was the sign by U.S. President Harry Truman, the sign he had on his desk in the White House, "The buck stops here." In other words, Harry Truman accepted the responsibilities that came with his presidency. Now, in contrast, tonight's section in the book of Luke deals with two men who pass the buck, two men who dodged their responsibilities, and we cannot dodge our personal responsibilities. So our section deals with Yeshua's civil trials before Pontius Pilate and King Herod. Luke covers the trial before Pilate in only 7 verses. However, the book of John gives us a detailed look at what happened in his gospel, chapter 18, verses 28 through 38. So consequently, we'll be shuttling back and forth between the account in Luke and the account in John, and we'll take a quick glance at Matthew and Mark where needed. Now, the reason for the two versions probably lies in the fact that Luke was a reporter. He was gathering information many years after the account, from those people who were not eyewitnesses to the events of Pilate's office. Now, they were eyewitnesses, but only to the external public details of the trial only. Now, John, in contrast, was an intimate disciple. He was personally taught by Yeshua for 40 days after the resurrection. So Yeshua probably was John's first-person source detailing what happened in the privacy of Pilate's office. Now, as the account begins, Yeshua has been declared guilty of blasphemy by the Sanhedrin. We looked at that last week. And the next step in the trial is to bring Yeshua before the Roman magistrate Pontius Pilate. Now, what were the Roman requirements for a trial? Well, the issue had to be sedition against Rome. Rome did not care one whit about Jewish religious standards. They could care less about the charge that Yeshua had insulted this Jewish God or that he even claimed to be God. They were idol worshipers. They believed in many gods. But the Romans did care that the proceedings had to be public, and they did care that the proceedings had to be based on a specific charge by a prosecuting witness. All right, well, let's begin our study of the text in John 23, verse 1. We'll look at the first phase of the civil trial as the presiding judge is introduced to us. Then the whole body of them, that's the Sanhedrin, got up and brought him before Pilate. Now, who was Pontius Pilate? Now, this bust is thought to be a likeness of Pilate. We haven't really been able to determine that. But Pilate was born in Spain and served as procurator in Israel from 26 to 36 AD. So this event happened smack dab in the middle of his procuratorship in 30 AD. Now, Pilate was famous for his cruelty. Now, this is an archaeological tablet that was found in Caesarea containing the name of Pilate and his office. And there, that's his name, Pilatus. Now, I know you can't read that very well. That's why the archaeologists put together this tablet that shows you which letters survived and which letters have not survived the ravages of time. And there it is, Pontius Pilatus, Praefectus Iudaea. He was a real person. Now, we learn some additional details in John 18, 28. Then they led Yeshua from Caiaphas into the praetorium. The trial takes place in the praetorium inside the Antonio Fortress. Now, here are some illustrations of the Antonio Fortress. This is Herod's Temple Mount, and in the northwest corner, the Antonio Fortress was built. This is where the Roman guards were housed. And here's a little bit of a close-up, and then you can see again the Antonio Fortress, where Pilate lived. Now this is the Temple Mount today, so when you go to Jerusalem, and you will go to Jerusalem one of these days, all of you, yes, yes, okay. When you go to Jerusalem these days, you will visit the Temple Mount, and this is how it looks today, and there's a school. There's a school right here sitting on top of the ruins of the Antonio Fortress. Now, this picture is a picture of Caiaphas's home. It's the church Peter in Gallicantu. The church of Peter in Gallicantu sits over the site of Caiaphas's home. So when you go to Israel, you can tour the basement of Pilate's house. That's all that's left, is the basement. And it's pretty extensive. And then to the right, you can see this first century stairway. It's been dated at the first century, and it would be the stairway that Yeshua was taken down to go to the Antonio Fortress. Now, I'm standing here halfway up the stairway, and of course you can see it going down into the valley there, and now I'm standing at the top of that stairway. And to our right, you can see a courtyard, and that's the courtyard where Peter denied his Lord. Now, this picture here is taken from approximately the point of view of Caiaphas's house. You can see it's looking down in the Tyropoean Valley. So Yeshua was taken down those stairs, and then he was taken through the streets of Jerusalem, and a logical route would be to turn north at this point and move all along this long major street along the western wall of the Temple Mount platform, and finally end up at the very northwest corner, which would be the Antonio Fortress. So that's probably how he was taken to Pilate. Now, we learn the time of day they take Yeshua to Pilate from John 18:28, and it was early. So it's the wee hours of the morning, but Pilate is dressed and ready to conduct a trial. The reason? Earlier that night, Judas went before Pilate and presented the official charge by which the Roman cohort could be released for the arrest. And since Pilate had earlier released the Roman cohort to Judas, Judas should have been there for the trial itself. Pilate is ready. He's all set to go. However, Yeshua is there, the accused, but Judas, the accuser, is not. This is the first problem the priests face. Another problem that for them centers around the Passover offering in verse 28. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Now that term Passover has caused all kinds of confusion regarding the date of the Last Supper. Was it on Wednesday? Was it on Thursday? Was it on some other day? Does the Gospel of John conflict then with Matthew, Mark, and Luke? What is that term Passover referring to anyway if it's already been eaten? What's going on here? Well, first of all, remember that the Jewish day goes from sundown to sundown, not sunup to sunup, as we reckon it. Now, here's the timeline. Now, the Jewish family would offer their Passover lamb on Thursday, the 14th of Nisan. Their Passover lamb is called the Pesach. That's Hebrew for Passover. So it's known either as the Pesach or the Passover. Now the sun would set, and the 15th of Nisan would begin. And then the Pesach offering would be eaten at the family's Passover Seder meal in the early evening. And remember now, the Pesach is eaten by the family. Now in the morning, there's a special sacrifice known as the Chagigah offering. By our reckoning, it is now Friday morning. The Chagigah is the official festival peace offering. The Chagigah is also known as, guess what, the Passover. It was offered immediately after the regular daily morning sacrifice at 9 o'clock in the morning by the priest. So this is Friday morning. Later on in the day, the priests partake of the Chagigah offering, not the family, but the priests. Then comes sundown, and the 15th of Nisan comes to an end. By our reckoning, Friday evening is also coming to an end as well. Now, the reason why they're afraid of eating this offering lies in the fact that this is a rabbinic tradition. According to tradition, they would be ritually defiled if they entered the home of a Gentile, and the ritual defilement would end at sundown. However, in the situation before us, they had to eat the Haggadah the same day that it was offered, Nisan 15. Also, they had to offer it in a ritually pure state, and in addition, they had to eat it in a ritually pure state. If they entered the Praetorium, they would suffer ritual defilement, and there was no chance for them to be cleansed of their defilement before eating the Haggadah. They had to eat it before sundown. Now, the point that confuses commentators is the fact that they don't realize that the Haggadah was also called the Passover. So let's look at it again. The term Passover applied to both sacrifices. So if this is the Pesach, then defilement is not a problem, because in this rabbinic tradition, defilement ends at sundown, and the Pesach was eaten after sundown. So the incident occurs early in the morning before 9 o'clock. Had this been the Pesach, they could have entered the Praetorium. They could have suffered ritual defilement. In the afternoon, their Pesach could have been offered by another family member. You didn't have to be a priest to offer the Pesach. Let's go down the timeline. The priests would have been cleansed of defilement after sundown, and then they could have eaten their Pesach in a ritually clean state. So the offering John refers to cannot be the Pesach, because there would have been an opportunity for ritual cleansing if it was. This is not the case if this is a reference to the Haggadah. So I'm going to run through it again. If this is the Haggadah, then defilement is a problem, because in this rabbinic tradition, defilement ends at sundown, and the Haggadah had to be eaten before sundown. All right, here's our timeline again. It's early morning. If they enter the Praetorium, they suffer defilement. At 9 a.m., they could not offer the Haggadah in a ritually pure state, because it had to be offered in a ritually pure state. Down the timeline to the afternoon. That afternoon, they could not have eaten the Haggadah in a ritually pure state. And then, at sunset, their defilement would be over. So John has to be referring to the Haggadah, because the priests would not have had an opportunity for ritual cleansing. Now, knowing this little fact of tradition solves the argument regarding when the Last Supper occurred. So let me throw one more chart at you, okay? One more chart. There's our timeline. On the 14th of Nisan, the Passover lamb was sacrificed, by our reckoning, Thursday afternoon. At sunset, the 15th of Nisan begins. The Pesach was eaten on the 15th of Nisan during the family's Passover Seder, by our reckoning, Thursday night. By our reckoning, Friday then begins at midnight. And then the events of Good Friday would have occurred: the trial early in the morning, the crucifixion early Friday afternoon, and finally the burial late Friday afternoon. So the book of John does not in any way contradict Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So have confidence in all your four Gospels. Now, here are some sources for further study if you're interested in it. I would advise you to add to your library The Temple, Its Ministry and Services by Dr. Alfred Edersheim. Dr. Edersheim is a Messianic Jew of the late 1800s. He has written a number of classic works, and this book is still in print, even though it was printed and written more than 100 years ago. If you want a more recent version, I would suggest you add to your library Yeshua, the Life of Messiah from a Messianic Jewish Perspective by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. All right, just on a side note here, I'm sure all of us recognize that the Pesach, the Passover lamb, typifies Yeshua. 1 Corinthians 5:7. Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. Why? For Messiah, our Passover, has also been sacrificed. So Yeshua is our Passover lamb, our personal Pesach. Now, in addition, the Chagigah, the Passover festival peace offering, also typifies Yeshua. The Chagigah was sacrificed at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 15th of Nisan. And likewise, Yeshua went to the cross at 9 o'clock in the morning on the 15th of Nisan. As Yeshua was being nailed to the cross, the Chagigah was being sacrificed in the temple. And the result is summed up in Romans 5:1. Therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Yeshua HaMashiach. Yeshua is our Chagigah sacrifice as well, our personal peace offering. All right, back to John 18. Now we know why they're afraid of defiling themselves. Therefore, they don't enter within the Antonio Fortress itself, and so our trial begins with some preliminaries, starting in John 18:29. Therefore, Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" Now, in accordance with Roman law, the proceedings have to begin based on a specific charge voiced by a prosecuting witness. According to the plan, Judas is supposed to step forward here. However, Judas is dead. Judas has committed suicide. He hung himself. Oh, what are the priests going to do? Verse 30. They answered and said to him, "If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you." So they have no witnesses, no accuser, so the attempt to force Pilate to pass a sentence apart from a witness or an accusation. Well, Pilate doesn't stand for any of this. He doesn't go for this. Verse 31. So Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. No accusation, no condemnation, no sentencing. I'm not concerned about Jewish religious law. And so the Jewish leaders now respond in verse 31. The Jews said to him, "We're not permitted to put anyone to death, to fulfill the word of Yeshua, which he spoke, signifying what kind of death he was about to die." Now, it's interesting that the Talmud tells us exactly at what point the Roman government took away from the Sanhedrin the power of capital punishment. The Talmud dates it at 40 years before the destruction of the temple. The temple was destroyed in 70 AD, minus 40 years. The date is 30 AD, the very year of this trial, 30 AD. Here's the Talmudic insight from the Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 41a. It has also been taught, 40 years before the destruction of the temple, the Sanhedrin were exiled from the Hall of Hewn Stones. They did not try capital charges. Capital charges could be tried only in the chief seat of the Sanhedrin, the Hall of Hewn Stones. Now we know exactly where that is. Here's a floor plan of Herod's temple, and the Hall of Hewn Stones is this chamber right here. And here's a drawing, a three-quarter view of Herod's temple. We can easily locate the Hall of Hewn Stones. It's located right there. This is the chief seat, or was the chief seat, of the Sanhedrin. Now, according to John 18:32, this is in the providence of God. This is the way God made sure that Yeshua dies in the manner that he said he would die, which is by crucifixion. John 12:32-33, Yeshua says, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." But he was saying this to indicate the kind of death by which he would die, being lifted up in crucifixion. Now, if the Sanhedrin retained their power over the death penalty, they would not have crucified anyone. Crucifixion was not a Jewish mode of execution. If the Sanhedrin had the power of execution, they would have stoned Yeshua to death. If Yeshua was stoned, there would be no atonement for us. That would have violated the manner Yeshua said he would die, and that would have violated prophecy. For example, Psalm 22:16, "For dogs have surrounded me, a band of evildoers has encompassed me, they have pierced, they crucified my hands and my feet." And then another example is Isaiah 53:5, "But he, Messiah, was crucified. He, Messiah, was pierced through. For our transgressions he was crushed," which means a violent, severe bruising. "For our iniquities, the chastening of our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. So this is the very year of the trial. This is the very year, under Jewish references themselves, that they no longer had the authority to execute anyone. This is God's providence, and it is also the fulfillment of Genesis 49:10. The scepter, that's the symbol of ruling authority. The ruling authority shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh, that's a rabbinic name for the Messiah, until the Messiah comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So the Sanhedrin's authority was removed when Shiloh was on the scene. So, being stymied by all this, the priests finally come up with an accusation in the Luke account, Luke 23:2. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Messiah, a king." So the accusation is finally voiced: sedition against Rome. Pilate has to take this seriously. Now, in view of this accusation, Pilate now calls for a private conference between Yeshua and himself. And we pick that up in Luke 23, verse 3. So Pilate asked him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Now, from Pilate's viewpoint, he wants to know, are you a competitor to Caesar? However, Yeshua responds in verse 3, and he answered him and said, "It is as you say." Yeshua's response is affirmative: "Yes, I am a king." John records the full response. Here's the full response in John 18:34. Yeshua answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" So Yeshua wants to know, on what basis are you asking this question? From the viewpoint of a Roman, a political basis, or from the viewpoint of a Jew, a religious basis? Now, Yeshua is not ignorant here. You know, he's not asking this question to gain knowledge. He knows what's going on. He's ministering to Pilate. He's asking in order to get Pilate to exercise faith. He's trying to draw faith from this cynical, cruel, pagan idol worshiper. He's evangelizing Pilate. Well, Pilate doesn't take the bait. Verse 35. Pilate answered, "I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? I'm not Jewish. I could care less about your religion. I'm interested in politics, the political realm." Well, Yeshua speaks up in verse 36. Yeshua answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews." You'd already have a riot going on against the priests. "But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." So Yeshua's answer explains the nature of the kingdom from the political perspective. Yeshua says, "I am not a competitor to Caesar." Now, there are amillennialists. There are those who don't believe in a literal kingdom here on earth. And so they like to use this verse to teach against the messianic kingdom. Yeshua says, "My kingdom is not of this world." Case closed. What they ignore is John 17, where Yeshua used the exact same expression of his disciples. So to say that something is not of this world is to not say that it would not be in the world. This comes out clearly in John 17 when Yeshua says this about his disciples. John 17, 16, "They are not of this world, even as I am not of this world." John 17, 16 means they are not of the world's nature. The kingdom of Messiah will be in the world, but it's not going to be of the world in the world's nature. Now, why? Well, it's because of the rejection of the Messiahship of Yeshua. His literal 1,000-year kingdom will not be set up at this time. In its place will be the mystery form of the kingdom. All right, Bob, explain that one, will you? Here's my explanation. The mystery form of the kingdom. During the mystery form of the kingdom, the king is absent. He's at the right hand of the Father, but he's ruling in the hearts of his followers, that's you and me, through the indwelling Holy Spirit. So the present mystery kingdom is not of this world. It's not of this world's nature, although its citizens, you and I, are very clearly in the world. All right, let's move on to John 18:37. Therefore, Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus said, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." So Pilate asks, "Are you a king in any sense of the term?" And Yeshua answers, "Yes, I'm the king of the truth." See, Yeshua wants Pilate to respond correctly to the truth. But how does Pilate respond? Pilate responds cynically and in unbelief, "What is truth?" The irony is that he looked at truth eye to eye. He looked at truth face to face. He looked at truth embodied, and he didn't recognize him. Didn't recognize him. Well, the result of this conference is the first declaration of innocence, Luke 23:4. Then Pilate said to the chief priests and crowds, "I find no guilt in this man. Yeshua is not a competitor to Caesar. He is no threat to Rome." However, more accusations follow. We pick it up in the Mark account, chapter 15, verse 3. The chief priests began to accuse him harshly. The response of Yeshua is silence in the Matthew account. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he did not answer. Well, Pilate asks for a response back to Mark. Then Pilate questioned him again, saying, "Do you not answer? See how many charges they're bringing against you." But Yeshua made no further answer. So Pilate was amazed. Well, there's no need for an answer. He's been declared innocent. He should be immediately released. Pilate shouldered the responsibility to set Yeshua free without delay. But Pilate breaks Roman law at this point. Now, let me add another side note here. At this point, we witness the fulfillment of Isaiah 53:7. Isaiah 53:7 states the Messiah would suffer in silence. Isaiah 53:7. "He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to a slaughter, like a sheep that is silent before its shearers, so he did not open his mouth." What I want to point out is that Isaiah 53:7 is not speaking of absolute silence. Yeshua chose silence at the proper times, yet at other times Yeshua had conversations with the Sanhedrin, with the priests, with Pilate. So he was not absolutely silent. However, in none of the conversations does he plead, does he threaten, does he beg, does he bully, or does he lie. He quietly and calmly answered questions and responded by appropriately stating the truth, like a lamb led to the slaughter. Now, amidst the accusation, someone finally mentions that Yeshua originates in Galilee. Verse 5. And they kept on insisting, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching all over Judea, starting from Galilee, even as far as this place." Well, Pilate's ears perk up as he hears that Yeshua is from Galilee. This gives Pilate the opportunity to pass the buck, to get out of this troublesome situation, to dodge his responsibilities, briefly. So Pilate passes the buck, verse 6. When Pilate heard it, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was in Jerusalem at that time. So Herod Antipas is in Jerusalem for Passover. Now Galilee is not under the jurisdiction of Pontius Pilate. It's under the jurisdiction of Herod Antipas. And so Pilate sends Yeshua to Herod for a trial. He passes the buck. And you know, we cannot dodge our personal responsibilities. So now we come to the second phase of the civil trial. before Herod and Antipas. We begin with Yeshua standing before Herod. Now, Herod Antipas was the son of Herod the Great and the murderer of John the Baptist. We pick it up in verse 8. Now, Herod was very glad when he saw Yeshua, for he had wanted to see him for a long time, because he had been hearing about him, and he was hoping to see some sign performed by him. Herod only wants Yeshua to do some magic trips for him. Entertain me. That's where his faith is. Verse 9. And he questioned him at some length, but he answered him nothing. Yeshua will not provide entertainment for this unbelieving and wicked man. Verse 10. The chief priests and the scribes were standing there accusing him vehemently. So Yeshua's accusers have followed him. They followed him to Herod's palace. And the chief priests and scribes stand there fiercely accusing him. Then, when Yeshua won't perform any magic tricks for anybody, Herod passes the buck. Verse 11. And Herod with his soldiers, after treating him with contempt and mocking him, dressed him in a gorgeous robe and sent him back to Pilate. So when Yeshua won't respond, it leads to mockery by Herod's soldiers. This is the second mockery Yeshua suffers. This second stage of the civil trial brings out a second declaration of innocence. Yeshua is sent back to Pilate. Why? Because he's innocent. Herod passes the buck as well. He dodges his responsibilities. He should have set Yeshua free. And we cannot dodge our personal responsibilities. Now, an interesting result of the trial comes out in verse 12. Luke 23, 12. Now Herod and Pilate became friends with one another that very day, for before they had been enemies with each other. So Herod and Pilate become buddies. Beforehand, they experience enmity between themselves. The source of the enmity between Pilate and Herod arises out of the fact that when Pilate first became procurator, he erected Roman shields on the temple walls in violation of the Jewish law that did not allow images in the temple precincts. This caused a riot. Therefore, Herod Antipas sent a letter of complaint to Caesar Tiberius. Tiberius ordered the shields removed, and because of that incident, Herod Antipas and Pilate were in a state of hostility. But as a result of this trial of the Messiah, and because Pilate had sent Yeshua to Herod, he therefore recognized Herod's authority over Galilee, the antagonism ceases, and they become best of friends. Now, 9 years later, in the year 39 AD, Herod Antipas, instigated by his wife Herodias, and Herodias also instigated him to arrest and kill John the Baptist, same lady there, in 39 AD, modest, unassuming, humble Herod went to Rome to seek the title of king. When he arrived in Rome, he was deposed by Emperor Caligula and then banished by the Roman Senate to Lyon in present-day France. He died there in poverty. He was to pay dearly for his role in the death of John the Baptist and his mockery of Yeshua. Pilate was deposed in 36 AD by Emperor Tiberius for ruling with cruel violence. He was called to Rome for trial. However, we don't know what happened to him after he arrived in Rome. He was likely exiled to France as well. Now, the church historian Eusebius recorded that Pilate committed suicide after the trial of Yeshua, though there's no evidence to confirm that record. So what's the end of the story? The end of the story, the mills of God grind slowly, but they grind fine. We cannot dodge our personal responsibilities. All right, what about us here in 21st century Portland, Oregon? How can we make this part of our lives? Well, the theme I chose for the application is standing for the truth. Now, in this section of Scripture, we saw Pilate declaring the truth, but then not standing in it. Yeshua was declared innocent. He should have released him. But he passed the buck on to Herod, hoping he would avoid dealing with the truth, with his responsibilities. We watched Herod mocking the truth, passing the buck back to Pilate so we wouldn't have to deal with the truth either. And in contrast, we see Yeshua simply, straightforwardly, and with dignity, stating the truth and standing in it. So, what about us? Well, here I start meddling in our lives. Let's use Yeshua as our example when we're put in a tough situation. Let's simply state the truth with dignity and stand firm on that statement. Let's not pass the buck off to someone else in the vain hope that we won't have to deal with our personal responsibilities. Standing with the truth means to be standing with God. Why? Because God is the God of truth. Isaiah 65:16. Because he who is blessed in the earth will be blessed by the God of truth. And he who swears in the earth will swear by the God of truth. Standing with the truth also means we stand with Yeshua, because he is the King of truth. Remember back John 18:37? Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." And Yeshua answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born. For this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." We cannot dodge our personal responsibilities. All right, let me close in prayer. God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Jacob, God our Father, thank you for Yeshua and all he did for us and all he suffered for us, all he went through for us. And Lord, Papa, we're living in a culture now that is throwing truth to the ground, all kinds of truth, whether it be biblical truth or historical truth or scientific truth, sociological truth. It's being thrown to the ground and stomped on and being taken over by man's ideologies. And man's ideologies are flawed and destructive, and we see that so clearly. So Father, help us. Help us if we get placed in a situation where we have to speak the truth. Help us to, just with dignity and with clarity, stand with you and our Messiah, your Son Yeshua, and state the truth and never waver from it. Lord, your word says, if you stay in my word, you are my disciples indeed. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Help us then to produce and to study and to show the truth to those around us, so that we may be set free from the sins and ideologies that are flawed and destructive in our culture today. Thank you, in Yeshua's name. Amen.